Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good afternoon, high school tennis fans. Welcome to the UR Ten Network, where you'll find all your tennis news. This is your host, Coach Denise, bringing you the FHS-TCA perspective on high school tennis. I think we have an exciting show for you this afternoon. Hopefully, if you've listened to some of the other shows on the UR10 Network, I know last night I finally got to listen to Coach Chuck Creasy's show. If you missed it, you want to look into it. He talks about the 10 components of being a champion, very important. I must admit I have company, and I haven't had a chance to listen to Lisa Stone's show next week, but she always has an outstanding broadcast. And, of course, Jason Haynes, the founder of the network, he has his show on a little bit after Coach Chuck Creasy, talking to some of the college coaches from throughout the country and what the challenges that they face in and the rewards. Today, we're fortunate that we have a college coach on. Somebody I met in 2002 at the High Performance Coaching Program. But before I get to him, I would like to just remind you that we have some events coming up. The high school tennis season in Florida is just starting. But in April, after the FHSAA State Championships, we'll be having our fifth annual All-Star Tournament, and Dean Street Insurance, Wilson Sports, Team Connections, and others will be helping us again to send off our high school kids off to college with a nice, fun tournament. So it's our time to honor the high school students. As you know, last month during our FACA workshop, we did our FHS-TCA tennis team coach certification. We also passed out the award, the Dean Street Insurance passed out their community service award. I remind you that whenever you look at an outstanding tennis program at a school, it's not just the players or the coach or the athletic director. Usually the programs that are year after year is involvement of the community. And we thank Dean Street Insurance for presenting the Community Service Award. If you don't have a Dean Street in your community, go to DeanStreetInsurance.com and see if they can help you. We also passed out the two Coach of the Year awards for 2015. That the Wilson presented those awards. Wilson has been with us. They'll be with us with the All-Star team. 100 years of leading sports in this country. It's always nice to have companies that's older than me involved. So we appreciate what Wilson does. And, of course, Team Connection gave out their free uniforms to the school that earned them. If you go to our website, fhstca.org, you will see how your school can earn free uniforms for the 2017 season. We believe in playing it forward. We all stand on the shoulders of somebody else, and Team Connection Tennis will again be providing free uniforms to a school in Florida, and of course they'll be with us for the All-Star Tournament. And now to our guest today. I've been privileged. I met our guest, like I said, in 2002. I think I see him on now. Let me see. Coach, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me, John?
Yes, I can, Coach. I'll be with you in about 1 minute. I just want to tell the folks, I think we today is special for a lot of reasons. Like I started to say earlier, I met Coach Bobby Bayless up in Maryland in 2002. I went through the high-performance coach while most of the coaches there are young coaches. When I walked in this room, I saw all these coaches around the gentleman that was older than him. And, of course, we get a list of who the 24 of us that went through. And so I knew, I said, that had to be Coach Bayless there. And he was gracious enough to share his knowledge with everybody. And I'm sure he'll do it again today. And interesting, right. Most people know Coach as coaching at the U.S. Naval Academy and then just retiring from Notre Dame University. Some of the people know he was Coach of the Year for a couple of two different times, years at the U.S. Naval Academy, I believe, and also at Notre Dame. But what impressed me and what I think should make an interesting show today is he actually started off coaching high school at Thomas Jefferson High School in Virginia. And in 1968, I think that was his first year there, but I know he won a state championship there. Coach, welcome aboard.
Thanks, John. Yeah, that year in 1968 was an awful lot of fun for me. It was my alma mater. I grew up in Richmond, Virginia, and Thomas Jefferson was one of the two or three schools that every year competed for the state title. And I had a dynamite team. And, for example, my number one player reached the NCAA finals in doubles. He and Freddie McNair, his name was Richard McKee, lost 7-5 in the fifth to Roscoe Tanner and Sandy Mayer in the finals of the NCAA tournament. And
wow.
My number two player played number one the next year for Penn State.
Wow. So let's be special to go back to where you sat there and went to school. I know one of our Coach of the Years was Casey Hemingway down in Pinecrest, and she won 5 gold balls and a lot of similar credentials as you. But to be the tennis director at the school that she went to high school with down in Boca, I always thought, boy, what a special thing. So that must have been really special for you.
It was, and I knew a lot of the kids on the team because they played tennis locally. And one thing it did for me is I was still a pretty active tournament player. It cleaned up my act because I knew if they watched me play in a tournament and I misbehaved, it would be difficult for me to say anything to them. So that helped me in that regard.
Very good. Very good. Let me ask you a question. Being from coaching both in high school and college, I'd like to start with the high school end of it, and being you go back that far. When you're I'm sure you had in a school like that, you had large groups of members there. How did you handle that with limited courts, or were you one of those schools that you had plenty of tennis courts?
Well, we had six courts and that for our use, and I remember, I probably had about 12 or 15 guys on the team, so there was plenty of courts. That really wasn't a big issue. We didn't have much of a budget for tennis. They supplied us, obviously, with balls. But the kids had their own rackets. And in order to get nice uniforms, I had the team do what we called work days. And we picked two Saturdays before the season started, one in the fall and one in the winter. And we would spread flyers throughout the neighborhoods, and we would work at that time. It was 1968. It was for $1 an hour, and so we would do anything and clean your basement, rake your leaves, cut your grass, whatever, wash your car. And a lot of the people in the neighborhoods contributed, and they would hire two of our guys to work for 4 hours, and then they'd give them extra money. And so we were able to when I say it was $1 an hour, my salary was $6,200 in those days, and we were okay with that, and it really helped us. And I think that the guys took some responsibility because they had some ownership, and I think I mentioned in an email to you, probably the neatest thing happened to us that year was, Penn State was in town to play the University of Richmond, which is my alma mater, and I knew the coach, and I had gone out the day before to see them play, and he called me at school and said that they needed a place to practice that afternoon, and they wanted to know if they could use our courts. And I was kind of joking with him, and I said, well, we'll scrimmage you if you want, and we'll play you, and he took me up on it. And so I went to my principal and told him we were going to play Penn State that afternoon at 3:00. And he made an announcement over the loudspeaker system and said that anyone in school had the choice of attending the regular 6-period class or going to the Thomas Jefferson Penn State tennis match. And we had 2,000 kids come out to watch us play. And we won the match.
I'm sure you did. 3. You beat Penn State too that day, huh?
Right, and their coach was pretty smart. He knew some of our guys, and he was trying to recruit them. And right after the match, our number two guy had beaten his number two guy, and he walked out and congratulated him. And he said, "What are your plans next year?" And he said, "Well, I'm still up in the air." He said, "Well, I'm offering you a full scholarship to Penn State right now. Would you like to come?" And he accepted it on the spot and was the number one player the next year at Penn State.
Very good. Boy, oh boy. I wish we could see more of that today. But unfortunately, one of the things that I've been yelling about, but I've also had some people complain, and I always ask the question, is your school treat tennis as an after-school activity or an after-school sport? And sometimes, I have some of the dominant teams in Florida say, wait a minute, we're dominant teams, and they are. About too many of the schools are in Ica tennis because they don't treat it as a sport. Their athletic directors and board of education are more concerned with getting somebody to monitor rather than coach. Would you like to beat me up too on that, or was there any comments on that?
Are you talking about from me or from the other people?
Well, from your opinion, I mean, even in Virginia, you were a dominant team. How many dominant, is that the norm, or is that, is there a handful of you?
No, there were, within the city, there were probably three schools that had nice tennis facilities, three or four schools had nice facilities, and many of them played at a public park instead. And I know, living here in South Bend, Indiana now, some of the schools have really nice facilities. They just don't tend to put a lot of money into it, and that trickles all the way through. We feel like we have things in pretty good position here at Notre Dame, but when you compare what we get with what football and basketball gets, it's a far cry. We don't get the attention. We don't, and that's just the way it is. And what we have to do is make our sport so popular that we change that.
Well, that's one thing that I've been working on for a long time, and we talk about our successes. I have to admit that in the last 20 years in Florida, I haven't been very successful. I've been sad. Sadly, I failed in that their effort. I just think my point is, when you see these half a dozen schools that are dominant and they're playing out of state and everything, they're playing out of state because there's not enough good competition at their level to play here. If there was a good level, and I asked the same question to the USTA, I think I know what you're feeling, but I'll let you speak for yourself. I mean, I think the high performance coaching program does an outstanding job. But is that the answer to having tennis be successful in this country, or should we be doing more for high school? Should the good player not go to high school, or should they play in high school? What do you think?
Right. Well, I never let high school tennis get in the way when I'm recruiting someone, because they're learning team skills, they're learning to be a teammate, that they're learning some good things. In some cases, they don't get a lot of competition if they're really good, but it's also a trade-off, and they're going to get plenty of competition in their tournaments. Some states have rules where you can't play during the high school season, you can't play in a tournament, and that's unfortunate. I do think a key to making tennis bigger is community involvement. And if the teams would have on an open weekend or on a Sunday afternoon or something, have a free clinic for the neighborhood or people in that area, and have families bring their little kids out or whatever, and do things to interact within the community, you would really get, a pretty positive reaction. And that's when your principal and your athletic director will start to be your best friends.
I agree with you. I think we've been blessed the last couple of years with the Florida High School Tennis Coaches Association. They have Dean Street Insurance pass out a community service award, and I think that it takes the community to really keep that program going and to keep the principals and the Board of Education on their toes. So it's more than sometimes we as coaches get too much credit, just like we get blamed too much when things are going wrong. But it really takes the whole community.
Yeah, it does. And college coaches need to learn that lesson as well. And maybe they need to learn it more, because, programs are being dropped because of unintended consequences of Title IX, I believe. You'll see a lot of men's programs are at risk, and you'll see schools like Arizona State that doesn't have men's tennis. That's hard for me to believe. And you've got to do a good job, and you've got to be relevant in your community. I think that's tremendously important.
I agree. University of Hartford announced that they're dropping their men's tennis team. Who would have thought we would be coming to this? And I'm not sure what the answer is. And I think it even goes down to some high schools. I know I was changed my thinking years ago because I saw I had a real good freshman class coming in, and I didn't have a lot of girls on the girls' side. On the boys' side, I had too much, and we were faced with the same thing, facing Title IX. The coach says, I don't want, you got to have an equal amount of girls. So we went out, and I told the boys, if I'm either going to have to cut you or you're going to have to give me some girls. And to their credit, they brought me a couple of cheerleaders who obeyed all the rules, came to every practice, and gave me a lesson in coaching. And those freshmen that we came later on went on to win a district title, and one of them a state championship. So
that's great.
Yeah, no, it's a problem, and it's an unintended consequence, like you said. I mean, I think it's important when you measure the whole thing. It's done so much good because you look at women athletes. I come from a basketball background, and I just love basketball. And you look at women's basketball today, and wow, it's just outstanding.
Yeah, it's come. It's probably grown as much as any sport that I've ever seen or, you know anything about. When I was in high school and college, the girls' games, there were six on the high school, our high school team, there were six girls that started. Three played on the offensive end and three played on the defensive end, and they didn't cross half court. So it was a different game. And now you turn on the TV and see some great basketball.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Well, Coach, let me ask you a question. As you know, I'm always trying to learn. What is, in your opinion, being you coach both, and I've never had the privilege of coaching college tennis, what is the biggest difference in your mind coaching high school tennis and coaching college tennis?
Okay, I think the kids are more impressionable in high school, and you can, in some ways, you can have a bigger impact on them because they don't think they're all grown up and sophisticated. On the other hand, at the college level, you're with them more. You travel with them. You go on spring break. You're gone for 9 days together. You're sleeping in the same hotel, eating your meals together. You do spend more time with them. At the college level, but for me, the fact that I felt like I could impact their lives more when they were in high school, and to me, coaching is coaching. You adjust. Teams are different. Eras are different. Age groups are different. But I think that the high school kids will actually listen to you and be more open to change and to your suggestions to an extent than the college ones will. And most of the guys you coach in college have been coached by a pretty good pro at some point or at the USTA level by one of the national coaches, and they some of them think they've heard it all. And generally it takes a while to break down those walls and develop the relationship that will allow you to do that, but they're very different. I can't say I enjoyed one more than the other. I have never felt like I was going to work since I first started coaching, and when I coached in high school, I taught English as well. And I think I've just been blessed to get into this profession. And but I'm trying to answer your question specifically. I think that probably you can make a bigger impact on the high school kids. The only thing about the college is you've got them more. You've got them for 4 years, and you're traveling with them, and you have control over the college team because you pick the players. You're recruiting the players.
Right.
In high school, whoever goes to that school, you're stuck with whether you like them or not. And in college, if you pick somebody you don't like, it's your fault.
Right. And I imagine, let me ask you, do you have more, I assume you have less involvement with parents at the college level than you do in the high school level. Is that correct or no?
That's mostly correct. You will occasionally get a helicopter parent who calls often to see how Johnny is doing. And one of the people I've relied on is Dave Fish at Harvard, who's a terrific coach. And he has a letter that I've read that he sends to all the coaches, and to all the parents. And it basically reads, "Dear Mr. and Mrs. Smith, we're excited to have Johnny on our team this year, and you're going to have a lot of questions from time to time, and I'm certainly here to answer your questions and help you. And I can tell you that you may not know what he's doing in a certain area or what classes and those kind of things. And I'll be happy to help you as much as I can. I don't want to entertain any questions about his status on the team." He sets that up right away. I've had a few parents over time that questioned my judgment as to whether their kids should be playing higher in our lineup. And at the college level, there's an added problematic area, and that's scholarships. If you give someone a scholarship and someone else is willing to come for no scholarship and develops into a better player, he's going to feel like he's earned the chance for a scholarship. But you can't take away the scholarship you offered. So that's, to me, the biggest problem in that area with parents. It's financial, and they may need the money, and so they're pinging on you from time to time about that. One thing that I did that would be helpful to high school coaches as well as college coaches is that twice a year I hand my team a ballot. And it's basically a typed sheet of paper, and it has everyone on the team's name in alphabetical order, not by class, not by ladder ability or anything like that, alphabetical order. And I tell them to take some time, spread out. I don't want anybody looking over anybody else's shoulder, and they're anonymous. And what they have to do is put a number with a circle around it, like a number one with a circle around it. That means that they think that player should be number one, all the way from 1 to 12 or 13 or however many players you have. And then I have them put another number on the other side of the name with a square around it, and that's the doubles ranking. So if you were picking who's the best doubles player on our team, you'd put number one and close it in a square. And that gives me the feel of the players. Now, I'm going to make the lineup up, but I'm getting some input from them. What it also does is when someone thinks they're getting a raw deal, if we have 12 players, I'll add up the total number of that you had by your name and divide by 12, and you might come out at 4.3. That meant you should be playing either 4 or 5 on my team. Based on the opinion of your peers. I have that information, and I keep all of the ballots, and on the back I ask them to write one constructive comment about each person. And again, this is anonymous. So that way, if I'm having a problem with a player and his attitude is poor and I can't reach him through normal channels, I will pull him into the office and sit him down and say, "I'm going to read you," and these are anonymous, and he can look and actually see the writing. "This is what your teammates said about you. Gee, I wish you'd work harder in practice. Or you need to do a better job in such and such an area." Or it might be real positive. I didn't want somebody to say, "You're a jerk," or "I don't like you." We don't get into that. It has to relate to their tennis, and it has to be constructive. And I save that, and that gives me the ability, if the player disagrees with me, not that I'm looking for it, and frequently I don't even use it, but I've got that as well as for a parent who thinks their son should be higher in my lineup and therefore could earn a bigger scholarship.
I think you've done that for quite a few years too, haven't you?
I think I've done it the whole time I've been at Notre Dame, and I can't remember if I did it at the Naval Academy or not. I think it started when I got here, and I'm not sure why I got the idea. I didn't copy it from anybody else. It just seemed to make sense. And what I wanted to know was I wanted their input, but I didn't want them to think they were going to set the lineup. I don't want a player higher than someone else because you like him more. And the lineup, the way I used it, it fluctuated as the year went on based on your dual match record. If I were playing number three and you were number four, and after 10 matches I was 5-5 and you were 10-0, well, I was going to switch those two players in the lineup. And they knew that, and they understood that. And there was some leeway there. If I lost all my matches 7-6 in the third and I played some nationally ranked players, then that would be taken into consideration. But my lineup was based on match play and match results, not on whether you could beat another player on your own team, because within the team structure, we all know each other. We all know our weaknesses. We all know how to get inside somebody's head. And it's not realistic. The competition itself is not realistic.
Yes, I think you shared that with us in 2002, because I had player-parent meetings for 3 months before the season start, the first Wednesday of September, October, November. Everybody knew that was coming, and I adopted something similar. Early on, I might have given credit to you, but my memory goes, I always tell people I'm not sure who I stole this from, but I know you shared that in 2002 in Maryland, and I appreciate it because I think it's very important. Let me ask you another question. One of the things, and sometimes my wife will beat me up on this here, is why do we have so many foreign people in the college now? Why don't we have more of our American kids in there? And I know she, if she's not listening now, I'm not sure where she is, but I'm sure she'll listen sometime. So let me hear your view.
I'll give you several reasons for it. Number one, there's a lot of pressure on coaches that didn't used to exist. When I first broke into coaching in 1969 at the college level at the Naval Academy, tennis coaches didn't get fired. I think if you were going to get fired, it had to be because you were involved in something illegal or immoral that was really bad, and that might lead to that. But if you didn't have as good a year as you were used to having, that didn't enter into play. Now they get fired all the time, and good coaches get fired just because they've had a couple of lean years because of their best player had a career-ending injury, or there are a whole bunch of things that could happen. And so number one is pressure. And so they're looking to get the best player, and they don't feel they have the luxury of just going with American players. The second part of that would be the Internet today. It's so much easier. I got letters, and I retired, as you know, at the end of the 2013 season. I would get letters. I actually still get them because some kids are using an old list, and they've got my name as the head coach. But from different countries, hi, I'm so-and-so. I would like to get a scholarship to your school. Here's what my ranking is, and here's a video, and all of that stuff. And so it's pretty easy to do compared to how it was many years ago. And some people do it just, I think, because it's easier, and they think that the foreign player is good, and it's pretty hard to check them out. I made it a policy to to have very few foreign players on my team. There were plenty of teams I had that were all American, and I never had more than one or two. But I wasn't against foreign players. I just felt like the scholarships and roster spots should go to American players. And I felt like I had to do that. And I've had some great kids that were foreign players, some of whom I'm in touch with today, and I'm very close to. I'm going to try to go to a wedding of an Irish player we had who's getting married in Dublin in March, and I'm trying to talk my wife into letting me fly over there for the wedding. But I really think the pressure was the first thing. And when I started coaching, it was unheard of to have performance bonuses in your contract. Now most coaches have performance bonuses. If you finish in the top whatever, 25 or 10 or whatever the school is, you'll get a certain percentage of your salary as a bonus. Many of the athletic directors today make it based on performance in the NCAA tournament. And one of the reasons this pressure exists is there is, for the last 20 years maybe or more, there's been a ranking of schools' programs. It used to be called the Sears Directors' Cup, and it's changed names over the years. And it was Capital One, I think, for a while. But depending on your NCAA finish, all the finishes would be added up for each team, and the schools would be ranked just like football teams are ranked, or tennis teams are ranked, or baseball teams are ranked. And so the overall athletic performance. Now, if you're an athletic director and you want to go from a mid-major to a major conference school, the best thing you can do is elevate your team's Director's Cup standing. If you were 140th in the country and 3 years later you're 71st, that's a pretty significant jump. And so when you're trying to get that next job, you can say, this is what we did. All these teams had better performances, and that'll help you land the job that you're looking for. So that brought on pressure to athletic directors that used to only worry about revenue sports, football and basketball. Now they worry about everything.
Very good. Okay, well, that better understanding. I know you brought up some things I didn't realize there, so I appreciate that very much. I don't know if I'm just watching some of the, I don't get a chance to watch a lot of college tennis on TV because there isn't that much, but occasionally, I don't know if it's a network, if it is, but I see more, a little bit more coaching or talking in between points. And I did at high school. I always tell the kids, you know, if I don't come out there to, you know, to talk to you, look for me. But if I'm not there, you know, I might just not be smart enough. If I don't see anything that I can help you with, winning or losing isn't what matters. It's how you're playing. Am I wrong that I see more coaching in between points than?
No, you're right. In some coaches do it a lot more than others. The rules are pretty clear. You just can't interrupt the flow of play. You can't stop and spend 30 seconds talking to somebody when he's supposed to be serving. But on changeovers and in between points, you can do it quickly. To me, I had to learn how to do this. That when I played, it wasn't allowed. And so when we first passed the rules to allow coaching, it was in the early 70s. And you really had to learn which kids could handle constructive criticism and which kids just needed a pat on the back and which kids needed to be left alone because you'd confuse them. And my rule was, when I come out to talk to you, I always had a little kind of legal pad and pencil with me. And I would write down, watching your matches, I would write down the things that you needed to do to improve your chances to win. whether they were technical within your game or strategic and tactic oriented, whether you need to come to the net more or do this, or lob more. And I would write it all down, and I would never tell you more than one or two things on a changeover. And once I wrote that, once I had told you, I put a check by that number. Number one might be come to the net more, so I'd check that. And then number two might be serve to the backhand or something like that, or it might be to use the width of the court more. It might be to you're making too many errors, or he's faster than you, and so you want to keep more balls through the middle of the court. It could be anything. But once I've said it, I put a check by it. If as the match goes on, I look back and I see you're not really doing what I said, I'll mention it a second time. And then I'll circle the check. And then the third time I have to tell you, I draw a line through it. And that tells me, look, I've told you this three times. Why don't you tell me why you're not doing it? Because they may not hear you. Their hearts are pumping, adrenaline's flowing, the emotions are high. You're talking to them, and all they're thinking of is, I got to win the next point. They're not listening to a thing you say. They may be nodding their heads. So I always made them repeat back to me what I had said. And once they did, I put a check by their name. And so I knew they had understood what I was telling them. Some people, you know, when somebody's choking, when a match gets close, generally there are two things you can do that are effective, that are a little out of the box. You can either make them mad at you, or you can make them laugh, and that's harder to do. I'll give you two examples. We were playing Southern California, USC, in 1992 in the semifinals of the NCAA tennis tournament. They were number one in the country, had won it the year before, and they won it the next 2 years. So we were in the middle of this heated match, and all of a sudden, singles were played first then, and matches were first to five rather than four today. Today you can win a match 4-3 because doubles counts for 1 point. Then the doubles were played second, and they counted a point each. Well, somehow we had gotten to the point where we were up 4-1 in this match, and we'd won some matches I didn't think we had much of a chance in. And our number one guy, David DeLucia, was dead even with Brian McPhee in the third set. It was 4-4 in the third, and David hit a great backhand down the line return serve winner that broke serve. And I looked at him, and I was excited. I was sitting on the bench, and he started walking toward me, and he looked at me, and I saw his shoulders drop. And I realized, uh-oh, he feels the pressure. He knows if he holds serve, we win this, and it'll be the biggest upset in the history of the NCAA tennis tournament. So he sat down next to me, and I took my hotel key out of my pocket. And I looked at him, and I didn't say a word. And he's waiting for some advice. But I've just got the hotel key lying there. And finally he looks at me and says, what the heck is that? And I said, see the girl in the red top in the third row up right over there? She gave it to me. She said, if you win this game, she'll be waiting for you in room 312. Well, he started laughing. And that was what I was trying to do, was to lighten the situation for him a little bit. He served out a love game. That's why I can tell that story. I'll give you one other one. We were playing Illinois in 2001, I think it was, and our player was Eric Inlove. And I had just put him in. It was his first big match. He was I put him in because he was really competitive. He wasn't super talented, but he was a tough competitor, and he wasn't going to beat himself. But he was really scared on that stage. We had a full crowd, and all of a sudden he lost the first set 6-0, and he looked lost. And I knew that I wasn't going to be able to make him laugh. And I knew he was a tough enough kid that I hoped what I was going to say worked. So I walked out to him at the end of the set. You have 2 minutes. And I said, Eric, when I recruited you, I thought you were a tough little guy. I was half right. You're a little guy. And I walked away. And I knew how mad he would be at me. Now, fortunately, the story has a happy ending. He got really mad and forgot about choking and wanted to prove something to me and won the next two sets 2-2 and we won the match. I could tell you some stories that didn't work, but I prefer to tell you the ones where I look good. But those are the kind of things. Usually on changeovers, it's, you know, it looks to me like he's getting in too much. Now, you must be hitting the ball short, or you need to get in more yourself, or I try to give him some sort of tactical advice. And it could be technical if, you know, your toss is backing up behind your head now. We worked on it in practice. Just think about that. So you really have to think about what you're going to say, and I write it down, and then I let them know. I make them talk back to me and repeat what I've said. The emotional stuff, making them mad or making them laugh, it depends on it, you've got to get to know your players pretty well and know what will work and what won't work.
I think that's the key, Coach, and I think that's would be the advantage of college over high school is getting to know the players and getting, you know, this is why I like having player-parent meetings before and everything. When you know the players, then you know what to do. And I know I always said, you know, I'm not going to treat you all the same because you're not all the same. I remember talking about laughing. I remember a girl that I worked with privately, and when she came to high school, and knowing her, I knew whenever she felt pressure, she would start to laugh. And so she's into that situation, and now she's starting to laugh. And during the changeover, I went up to her, and I said, I won't say who she was. I said, if I hear you laugh once, I said, when the match is over, before you go home, you're going to do lines for 20 minutes. And this girl coming by says, Coach, you always say that we should be happy, and you're telling her not to laugh. I think I would cry if you talked to me that way. And I said, well, that's why I don't talk to you that way. But no, I think that's the nice thing about college is you get to know the players, and it's hard to give advice if you don't know them.
Right. And so I would frequently, before I said anything that I thought might impact somebody, I felt I had to get to know him first, and before I took the chance of insulting him or trying to make him laugh.
Well, Coach, I can't believe it, but we've gone through almost an hour here, but I wanted to hear at least one more interesting thing that happened during your college experience, if you would be so kind.
I'll tell you a funny story that happened to us in 1970. Now, keep in mind, I was about 25 years old, and I was a coach at the Naval Academy. And many of the listeners weren't alive then, but that was a tough time. You had the Kent State situation, which set off riots on college campuses, and there was a very anti-military, because of Vietnam, tone. And a number of the Ivy League schools closed down, and we were in a league with the 8 Ivies, Army and Navy. We went to play Brown up in Providence, Rhode Island. And at the end of the match, we went in and used their locker room and their field house to shower. And we came out. And when we came out, we were traveling in two large station wagons. And they were gray, and they said U.S. Navy on them. And we had gotten them from the naval station at Quonset Point right there in Providence. So we walked toward our cars, and there were several hundred people with signs, fascist pig, warmonger, we hate you, and they were screaming and yelling at us. And this was going on different college campuses. So we were really taken aback, and I told the guys, get in the cars quickly, and let's get out of here. Well, as we closed the door, got in the cars, the crowd surrounded us, and we couldn't drive because we would kill somebody. We'd run over them. And they were yelling and screaming and some spitting, and it was really ugly, and I was scared. And I remember thinking, I'm going to be on the 6 o'clock news tonight. One particular guy was screaming, and he said, you're warmongers, you're fascist pigs, What do you have to say for yourselves? And several of them joined in that chant. What do you have to say for yourselves? And I had a young guy on our team who was from Alabama, and he had a lot of personality. And he was sitting in the back where the tailgate was. And he said, "Coach, roll down the window. I think I can talk to these folks." And I remember thinking, no, I'm not going to roll down the window. They might throw something in here. I was thinking Molotov cocktail. I didn't know what to do. He said, "Well, at least crack it. I can talk to these people." So I rolled the window down about 6 inches, and they had just yelled again, "What do you have to say for yourself?" And so he stood up and put his mouth right there where the opening was, and they got quiet because they could see that he was going to answer them. And he said, "Y'all want to know what we have to say for ourselves?" And they all boomed, "Yes, we do." And he said, "Well, war is our business." And then he paused and he said, "And business is booming. Hit it, coach." A couple of them laughed, and I put the car into gear, and it moved just a little bit, and the crowd backed up, and we just drove right out of there. So that's something that I haven't had to do in a long, long time, but that's one of the funnier stories that when I look back on my career, it's a little different from what you get normally.
Have you been back to Rhode Island and Brown and Providence since?
I haven't been back there as a coach. I've been back in that area, yes. And I really I look back on those years. We had in 1970, that year, Yale forfeited to us because they didn't want us to wear our uniforms onto the campus. And our athletic director said, "Well, the last time I checked, New Haven, Connecticut is in the United States, and we're going to show up, and we're wearing our uniforms." And they forfeited the match to us. So I had a win my first year over Yale that I didn't work too hard to achieve.
It's amazing what a certain time can be. I was stationed in Quonset Point as a Marine in 1960, I think it was, and it was, God, I had some great times there. And then in the 90s, I was tennis coordinator for the World Scholar Athlete Games at the University of Rhode Island, and I don't think that those dorms changed from when I was in the Marine Corps earlier, but it's a beautiful place. So it's amazing what the time can do. Coach, I appreciate you taking the time to be on our show. I appreciate, I'm looking forward to being able to talk to you in person today, but it was a special talking with you today, and I do need to remind our audience about a few things coming up. Like I said, we have our All-Star Tournament in Orlando in April following the season. In Florida, you have to be, once you're playing an All-Star event, your high school career is over, and that's why it's for seniors only, and please nominate your players for the tournament. Let them know. Like I said earlier, we gave out the Wilson Coach of the Year Awards in the 1A, 2A, 3A, and 4A this year. And I always say, if you have a complaint, let us know. Let the athletic director know. Just don't do it on the tennis courts. But in the same respect, if you have a coach doing a good job, for God's sakes, recommend them to be honored as Coach of the Year. Wilson, speaking of Wilson, if you haven't bought your balls yet for the coming tennis season, there's a great deal on 9 cases, and you get free shipping in a free case with Team Connection. So, contact them. And you'll find all these things on our resource page. A resource page, I think, is an important tool for the coaches. There's not only discounts given there, but there's lectures given there. For instance, Human Kinetics, they are the They partnered with us doing our tennis team coach certification, and the agreement we have with Human Kinetics is actually that the FHSTCA tennis team coach certification, that could be an Illinois certification, it can be a Pennsylvania, it can be a Virginia certification. If you have a state organization, you could take our program and turn it into whatever your high school coaching organization is. But please make sure your coaches stay trained well. You'll see the Billie Jean King I coach on there, and you'll see that you could buy it cheaper there than you could buy it if you go to the Billie Jean King website themselves. You also, the Total Serve there. If you buy the Total Serve from their site, you'll pay one price. If you buy it from our site, you buy it at 25% less. If you don't buy it from our site and you pay more for it, please don't come to us and ask for your 25%. You have to go on our site to buy it there. Technitech. Tennis, the tennis teaching training through video sequence. John Eagleton, you remember the South African pro, and right, actually Florida, he played at the University of Miami. You've seen his program on the tennis channel. They have one of the biggest library, video libraries going there. It's not a tool for everybody. Everybody learns differently. Some people need these videos. Again, you can get that at a 10% discount through our site. I'm recruitable. Coaches talk to us about going into colleges and what they do and the amount of people coming in from overseas. I'm recruitable, helps families successfully navigate the college sports recruiting process. And besides the Division I's, where else? Besides scholarships, there's money available other ways for college. And, yes, I've had some people say, well, gee, I'm recruitable. They bring people in from overseas. Yes, they do. They bring people in the American colleges from all over the world, but if you watch their videos on our training site and everything, you can see they're helpful for us. They've been helpful with our high school teams. So just be aware of those. I think that we try to provide a lot of information for you. I think our radio show, I mean, to be able to hear Coach Bobby Palis today, the experience he has. Like I said, I remember in Maryland seeing him for the first time and all these young coaches that were going through the high-performance coaching program going over around him because they knew what he had to offer. And, of course, when I went in, I surrounded him, and I became hopefully I didn't become a pain, but I had as many questions back then as I have now for him, and he was just as courteous back then. But there's lessons to be learned here, and, you know, and I always say go out there and help the new coaches out there. When somebody with the credentials of Coach Bayless can take the time and be on our show and share that information with you, Coach, I thank you so much. And anything you would like to say before we go off the air?
No, I'm very happy to have been able to do this. And if anybody has any questions, you know, they can get a hold of me at rbayliss, B-A-Y-L-I-S-S, at nd.edu.
Thank you, and take advantage of it. There's lessons out there all the time. Coach, I thank you for joining us today. I look forward to our next conversation. And thank you again for being on the show.
Thank you,
John. Next week we will have, who do we have next week as guest? We have Scott Engel from, February. We have Brian Slack, another college coach, but from a different perspective. They're from ASA College. They moved from New York to Miami. They still have a campus in New York, but this is a two-year college. Everybody is not ready for a four-year college. There's a growing everybody grows at a different time. So I'm sure Brian will have a lot to talk to you about. Have a blessed week. Please tell your friends, and I look forward to talking with you next week. Bye now.
Bye.